Funding for Think comes from the SMU Master of Liberal Studies program.
As we speak, there's a battle for votes in the Senate. It's a fight for a bill that would fundamentally change the healthcare system. By now, you've probably heard the big numbers. 22 million, that's how many people the Senate healthcare bill would leave uninsured by 2026, according to the nonpartisan Congressional Budget Office. 321 billion, that's the amount the federal deficit would decrease over the span of a decade. 50, that's the number of Republican votes it will take to get the bill through the Senate. There are enough numbers to make you feel like you're swimming through a bingo ball cage. But what do they mean for you? From KERA in Dallas, this is Think. I'm Lauren Silverman, in for Chris Boyd. And this hour, we're talking about the Senate healthcare bill with Van Newkirk. He's staff writer at The Atlantic, where he covers politics and policy. Van, welcome to Think.
Thanks for having me.
All right. So the nonpartisan Congressional Budget Office, or the CBO, dropped its report card of what's known as the Better Care Reconciliation Act of 2017 yesterday. And not long after, one of the few Republican holdouts, Maine Senator Susan Collins, said she'd vote to block the bill. What was in the report card that you think turned her off?
So the big number there in the CBO report is that the Senate version of the health care bill will increase the number of uninsured people over baselines by 22 million. And that's just 1 million less than the House health care bill, which people thought the Senate bill was going to be a lot more moderate, was maybe going to get that number under 20 million, which I think would have allowed moderate Republicans like Collins to say, look, this bill is better. We'll vote for it. But in the final analysis, CBO finds it's only 1 million people better, I say, than the last bill. And Collins' initial, I guess, reservation about the House bill was that 23 million number. So the 22 is not much different.
Yeah, it's not. I saw some people estimating 15 million, which would have been substantially lower as well. But that other number I mentioned, the 321 billion, that's the amount that the CBO estimates the federal deficit would decrease over the span of a decade. That seems like a significant win for Republicans.
Oh, yeah, definitely. It's much better on the deficit than the House bill, which was only about $119 billion. And I think it looks good for the four more conservative Republicans in the Senate who said they did not support it at first. But you've got to look at where those cuts to the deficit come from. And those directly affect people in Collins' camp because most of those cuts come from Medicaid. It's about a $1 trillion cut over a decade to Medicaid, which I think by almost any metric, unless you get really creative, is going to have to see states reduce the number of people enrolled or reduce what they cover. There's no other way.
All right. We'll talk a little bit more about Medicaid later in the show, because there's some drastic changes that would be made by the Senate healthcare bill. But before that, I want to figure out how you're approaching analyzing the Senate healthcare bill, because as I think about it, there are different ways to compare it. You can compare it to Obamacare numbers. You could compare it to the House bill released a few months ago. Or you can compare it to pre-Obamacare. So how are you trying to gauge what it does well and what it doesn't?
Well, I think in terms of policy, analytically, you want to take the CBO approach, which is studying it as an extension of Obamacare. That's what the law really is. And you want to look at the numbers based on an Obamacare baseline. And that's where the 22 million number comes from. But I think politically, what you really want to look for is how it fares over the House bill. The House bill was a pretty dicey proposition to pass the lower chamber, and the senators have signaled what they want as different from that bill. And so you really have to peg, okay, the CBO's given it a score. How does that compare to what those senators wanted over the House bill? And actually, it seems so far it doesn't deliver what either the moderates want or the more conservative people want. And finally, when you're looking at it versus the pre-Obamacare status quo ante, is you really want to look at, okay, Obamacare claimed to do this, and now Republicans are claiming they can do this better. And how does it compare really against what life would have looked like, what it would have looked like in 2009, say 10 years down the road from there? And actually, in many respects, the Better Care Reconciliation Act actually reduces some coverage estimates from pre-Obamacare world. So it reduces Medicaid spending even over that level. And actually past 2026, it does that even more. So I think the CBO does a little bit of this, and analysts are doing a bit of this as well. But you really want to consider all three of those baselines: pre-Obamacare, Obamacare, and then over the House bill. And maybe when the Senate has another draft come through, we'll be comparing that draft versus this first draft.
God, it's a lot to juggle. It's a lot to juggle, especially for people who don't have the time to read through the 50-page or whatever it is, CBO report, which is pretty, they did a pretty good job of summarizing some of the main points, but I'm going to have you help walk us through it. To start by looking at the differences between the law today and the law that would be in place if this Senate bill passes, let's begin with one of the least popular elements of the Affordable Care Act, which is the individual mandate. What would happen with the individual mandate, the requirement to have health insurance that's in place today?
So the Senate plan, like the House plan, gets rid of the individual mandate. That's a tax. It gets rid of that tax and the other mandates as well. So under this plan, there's actually no tax penalty if you don't receive insurance. But there is a new draft that basically backs into a sort of requirement that it requires you to have continuous coverage, or you can be locked out of the exchanges for 6 months.
Huh. And so this lockout provision, that was a recent addition, right?
Right. That came just before the CBO score hit Monday.
And so that is trying to create an incentive to get people to sign up for healthcare and not wait until the last minute. Do you think it could work?
I think it might have the intended effects policy and spending wise. It'll definitely reduce sort of the risk of what's called the death spiral in exchange markets. It'll reduce the amount of sick people who find out they get sick and then go get insurance, which will make your risk pools look a little bit better. But it actually, it stinks for people who are in that situation who will have no access to care whatsoever. It's balancing priorities here, and it looks good, I think, from a fiscal perspective. The CBO looked kindly on it, but when you're placing yourself in the shoes of people who may not be able to afford healthcare, who may lose a job, who may have a spouse who dies, and they don't immediately pick up new insurance right away, and they say, find out they have breast cancer, and now they can't get insurance. President Trump said he was looking for a bill with heart that was less mean. I don't know if that's it.
To be fair, though, I think under the Affordable Care Act requires you to wait right until the next year to get insurance. So it's not a completely new idea. It's slightly different.
Right. There are open enrollment periods when you can find and purchase insurance. But the public insurance options, especially under Medicaid, are more robust.
Yes. Now, some people, including former President Obama, has said that this healthcare bill is really a tax bill. What is intended by that?
Well, it is. When I told you about that $1 trillion cut to Medicaid, you notice it only saves in the aggregate about $300 billion total. And that's because there are $700 billion worth of tax cuts in the thing. There's the repeal of the mandate, which itself is a pretty big tax. There's a repeal of the employer taxes. There's a repeal of the other various taxes that make the Affordable Care Act work. And there's also things like a reduction on the limits to which really rich people, executives in health insurance companies can claim deductions. And what those do, I think there's a recent analysis by the Tax Policy Center that shows that about 67% of those tax cuts actually benefit people making the upper quintile of income. And so this really boils down to a tax cut for people making the most.
How have insurance companies responded to the Senate healthcare bill? They're constantly looking for some reassurance, some policy stability.
Yeah, the watchword for them is stability. I think what they are hoping for above all is to know what the next bill is going to be early, and to have some sort of assurance that A, the Senate and the Congress will pay them what they're supposed to pay them under the ACA. The Senate bill has actually signaled that they will continue to do that. But they're also looking at, okay, the CBO has a section in its analysis that looks at the market stability, which is, you know, it looks at how likely the provisions are to cause a death spiral, how likely they are to put only sick people in the markets. And for what it's worth, the Senate bill is better than the House bill, but I do think there are some reservations among insurance companies as to whether the subsidy people are getting for exchange programs is going to be enough, whether what the Senate's putting into the private exchanges markets there is going to be enough to stabilize them. That's still a bit of an open question, and I'm looking to more insurance company responses as the week goes on. But another thing is they are using right now the prospect of the ACA exchanges failing as leverage so they can get what they want out of a Senate bill.
Oh, interesting. So where there's problems or disagreements, there's opportunity for them as well. Now, let's talk a little bit about the overall increase in coverage, the number of people covered under Obamacare, because those numbers get tossed around a lot. About how many people nationwide got health insurance as a result of Obamacare?
That's a fun question. I think most people are settling around the 20 million number so far. But what's tricky about that is you have people who may have already been eligible for Medicaid before, who just found out about it and joined up because there were more, you know, there was a little bit more publicity. You look at people who enter the exchanges, who left from employee plans. It's kind of fuzzy like that, but I think it was always intended to be fuzzy. But I think the solid estimate here is somewhere north of 20 million.
And here in Texas, I know the number, the estimate is about 1.3 million Texans who bought health insurance under the Affordable Care Act. Or no, I'm sorry, that's the number that actually seen their options narrow. It was much higher. But the number, there are a majority of those people in Texas have seen their options narrow on the exchange. What does the Senate bill do to create more options for people searching for health care?
Well, and this is one unavoidable problem of the Affordable Care Act as it is today, is I think on average, everyone everywhere across the country is seeing their options on the exchange decline. And in turn, they're seeing their premiums increase. And I think that's a real pressure that whatever the bill looks like coming out of the Senate, it needs to fix. But this bill, as it stands, it may not do just that right away. One thing it does do is it allows plans to offer what's called a plan with a lower actuarial value. So you have different levels of plans in the marketplaces. You have bronze plans, you have silver plans, you have upper tiers above that. And what that means is what percentage of your services are covered with your premiums. So right now, a benchmark plan is a silver plan, and every exchange plan in every exchange in the country has to give you offer silver plans, right? But under the Senate plan, now insurers would be able to offer plans with less actual value, so they have lower premiums but higher deductibles. And I think that will actually entice more insurers to offer plans in the marketplaces. They can offer more bare bones plans in states that waive essential health benefits. So it actually will, that's an incentive for insurers to offer more plans.
More plans, perhaps more bare bones. You're listening to Think on KERA. I'm Lauren Silverman, in for Chris Boyd. Our guest this hour is Van Newkirk. He's staff writer at The Atlantic, where he covers politics and policy. Join the conversation. Share your thoughts. Call 800-933-5372 or email think@kera.org.
Funding for Think comes from the SMU Master of Liberal Studies program for aspiring creative writers. You can nurture your creative talents and take courses this fall like 21st Century Storytelling. Applications are available at smu.edu/MLS.
You're listening to Think on KERA. I'm Lauren Silverman, in for Chris Boyd. Today, we're talking about the Senate healthcare bill. And let's start by hearing from two Republicans who are opposed to it.
This current draft doesn't get the job done. But I believe we can get to yes. I believe we can get this done. There is an agreement to be reached. And I have been, for the last 5 months, working around the clock to get to that agreement. And I still believe we can get there. The key to getting an agreement, to getting a bill that can pass, is we need common sense reforms in the bill that lower the cost of premiums. The single biggest reason that so many people are unhappy with Obamacare, that are hurting under Obamacare, is because it's caused premiums to skyrocket. When I'm home in Texas, I hear over and over again from Texans who say, I can't afford health insurance because of Obamacare. We've got to fix that. The current draft circulated this morning doesn't do nearly enough to lower the cost of premiums, but there are a number of common sense reforms that have wide agreement within the Republican conference that we can include, and I think we should include.
Obamacare made it illegal to buy inexpensive insurance. If I have a 27-year-old guy and I don't want pregnancy coverage, I cannot buy an inexpensive policy. They price me out of the marketplace, and therefore I don't buy it at all, and that leads to the whole death spiral of Obamacare. All of that remains under this, and I'm not voting for something that looks just like Obamacare and still doesn't fix the fundamental flaw of Obamacare.
That was Republican Senator Rand Paul of Kentucky on ABC News Sunday, and Republican Senator Ted Cruz before him of Texas on CNN Thursday, announcing he would not vote for the House bill as it is, but was open to talking about revisions. We're talking about the Senate healthcare bill with Van Newkirk II. He's a staff writer at The Atlantic, where he covers politics and policy. Van, as we speak, there's this scramble to get Republican senators like Ted Cruz and Rand Paul on board with this bill. What kinds of concessions or changes could be made to get them to a yes?
Well, I think both of them have to be looking favorably at the recent CBO report, because it did find that premiums would decrease under the Senate plan because of that bare bones thing we talked about last time. But I think the easiest way to entice them to join, and I think it'll happen, is there will be some more concessions to that point. So maybe the revised plan will allow even sort of less comprehensive plans to be offered on the exchanges. It might add a little bit more in terms of subsidies, although I can't see that as a likely route forward. What I really think is going to happen is they're going to say, look, we may allow states more flexibility to decrease essential health benefits for the plans that are on the marketplaces. They're going to might allow plans a little bit more leeway to provide less comprehensive services and products, and that will in turn reduce the premiums number in the next draft of the CBO, which will, I think, bring on those more conservative Republicans to this bill.
But it seems like you might be able to get them on board, but the Senate Republicans are stuck. And I was trying to think of an analogy, and then I was like, Goldilocks, but Goldilocks doesn't really work. So I thought of a different one. Let me hear what you think. It's sort of like most Republicans have settled on vanilla, and the holdouts want either chocolate or strawberry. So is there a Neapolitan option, a way to get all of them satisfied with this bill?
Well, if this were another, I think, cycle, a legislative cycle, it might be different. If we weren't staring down the barrel of a recess coming up for the summer, it might be different. I don't think the conservative Republicans are all that far off from what they want in this bill. But the problem is, what Mitch McConnell needs is for them to move to proceed on a vote almost right away. And that will basically get rid of the time for them to appease the people on the right, and then go in and try to pick up one or two of the moderates. They need to do that in a day, and they will not be able to do that in a day, I think. And that makes it basically so now, if they don't proceed with a bill that's almost ready to go to floor, like right away, they have to go home. They have to see people back home. They have to go to town halls. They have to, and I think we saw what happened with the rounds of town halls during the House debate over the AHCA, that's what nobody wants in the Republican Party.
Let's go to the phones now. Michelle is calling from Dallas here. Hi, Michelle. How are you doing?
I'm doing fine. How are you?
Good.
I got to say, so many comments, so little time. The question I have is, everybody keeps talking about the number of individual options that have been reduced on the marketplace, but all of the options for individuals are reduced off the marketplace as well. It's not just these marketplace plans. If you are an individual and don't have group coverage, your choices have been eliminated in all aspects, and I don't really understand why they're doing that.
Good question. Van, you want to respond?
Yeah, I think that was actually one of the problems the ACA was hoping to fix, was people who don't have employer coverage, who don't qualify for Medicaid, have always been in kind of a bind. And I think they've always had fewer choices and less desirable choices. Unfortunately, I don't think the ACA as constituted quite solved that, and Congress in its decision not to pay insurers their agreed upon rates has exacerbated that problem. And I don't think the Senate or the House bill actually fixes it. It's still a bind that we as American health policy people and politicians really haven't quite figured out yet.
You can also join the conversation by calling 800-933-5372 or by emailing think@kera.org. Let's talk a little bit about how the Senate bill would change Medicaid, because it's pretty big changes, right?
Right. It would be the biggest change to Medicaid in its 50-plus year history now. It gets rid of the Medicaid expansion under Obamacare, which was, you know, it didn't happen in Texas, but states that chose to expand Medicaid to low-income, able-bodied adults, they could do that under Obamacare. And that could never have been done before. So you had millions of people who gained coverage that way. The Senate bill would phase the funding for that expansion out over the next 4 years. And I think most states would in turn drop that provision who have expanded. Seven states automatically by law, if Congress changes any portion of their Medicaid funding scheme, they automatically drop it. And I think others, maybe aside from, say, California, New York, your standard liberal bastions, they would drop the expansion too. But actually the bigger change to Medicaid is the Senate bill fundamentally alters its funding structure. It changes it to a per capita cap where today, Medicaid is open-ended funding. So if you, say, spend $200 a year on your health care, Medicaid pays for that. If you spend $200,000 a year on your health care, Medicaid pays that. But under the Senate bill, they would give you a fixed amount every year per person that your state covers, and the state would basically have to deal with that money and couldn't go over that amount. And what health policy experts, I think, across the board are saying, not across the board, there are some conservatives who agree with this tack, but what it would do and what the CBO thinks it would do is it would force states to basically over time enroll fewer people and offer fewer services.
Now, in a state like Texas, as you said, that chose not to expand Medicaid, what would the ultimate effect be? Would it be less severe than it would be for another state?
Actually, there have been several analyses saying that Texas and other large states that have not expanded would actually see plenty economic problems happen as a result of that Medicaid contraction as well. Because Texas, although it has not expanded to low-income, able-bodied adults, it still has one of the largest Medicaid populations in the country. Because of people who were eligible under traditional Medicaid before Obamacare. And what the Affordable Care Act would do is say, Texas, you have so many people on Medicaid this year, and we're going to give you so many dollars per person. And actually, that would affect a state like Texas the most, because Texas's populations that are eligible for Medicaid are growing. You have lots of people, lots of low-income mothers, lots of immigrant parents and children who would be likely to be eligible on Medicaid, who now are facing a diminishing slice of the pie over time. So actually, Texas, its economic activity, its gross state domestic product, its ability to cover people will be diminished over the next 10 years, and then again over the decade after that.
And just to put some numbers out there, as of February 2017, 4.5 million Texans were enrolled in Medicaid, and about 3 and a half million almost of those enrolled are children, which is an interesting point to bring up. It's really not the people that sometimes are stereotyped to be on Medicaid.
Right. I think what most people don't realize about Medicaid is there are minimum levels for everybody. So you have to cover disabled folks and poor kids. That's about the extent of Medicaid's most minimum requirements. But every state covers way more children than actually is required under federal law. They cover children in lower middle class homes in lots of states. And so what happens over time is when you're looking at states that are now under this law have to tighten their belts, have to figure out a way to make their Medicaid budgets lower, the population of people that would likely be most affected by this are children who are covered and don't have to be covered under federal law.
You can join the conversation about the health care bill, the Senate health care bill, by calling 800-933-5372 or by emailing think@kera.org. Let's go to the phones. Let's go to Julie, who's calling from Dallas. Hi, Julie.
Hi, thanks for taking my call. Following up on the Medicaid portion, you know, Texas has the leanest and meanest requirements for Medicaid. And one of the populations to be hurt most are, as you said, people with disabilities. My daughter has Down syndrome, and people with intellectual disabilities comprise 132,000 people on the wait list for something called home and community-based services. Now, that's considered a waiver or an optional Medicaid program, and what we fear, what we know, is that that will be the first to be cut, optional Medicaid waivers. And that means that people with intellectual disabilities, including my child, will be at increased risk of institutionalization. So these Medicaid cuts not only threaten our lives and access to care, it also threatens our children's freedoms. And so we are terrified of this bill.
And have you been out to protest? There's been a few protests, I believe, in Texas, Julie.
Absolutely. In fact, a huge group of parents of medically fragile children have met at Cornyn's office. We've talked to Cruz.
Senator John Cornyn.
Yeah. They just are concerned about the tax breaks, and they're okay, it seems, with letting that come at the cost of the freedom and the lives of people with disabilities. And that's unacceptable to us.
All right. Thanks for your call, Julie. So, Van, politically speaking with Medicaid, how are the Republicans? I know Senator Susan Collins from Maine is pretty perturbed by these cuts, and we actually have a clip of her. Let's listen to that clip of we don't have that clip. I'm sorry. We have a clip from Elizabeth Warren, though, talking about Medicaid. Let's listen to her talking about the cuts.
Medicaid is the program in this country that provides health insurance to 1 in 5 Americans, to 30 million kids, to nearly 2 out of every 3 people in a nursing home. These cuts are blood money. People will die. Let's be very clear. Senate Republicans are paying for tax cuts for the wealthy with American lives.
You're listening to Think on KERA. I'm Lauren Silverman, in for Chris Boyd. Our guest this hour is Van Newkirk. He's a staff writer at The Atlantic, where he covers politics and policy. That was Elizabeth Warren, Democratic senator of Massachusetts, talking about the amount of tax cuts and Medicaid in the House bill. Is there any chance of getting support from people like Maine Senator Susan Collins, who said the cuts to Medicaid are too drastic?
Yeah, actually, Collins, in her statement, she cited Medicaid almost exclusively as her reason for not being behind the bill currently. And I think you have lots of Republican senators who are in states like Collins' Maine, where they rely on Medicaid funding extensively for covering poor people, low-income folks in the state, and especially states like Maine, where they're dealing with the opioid crisis. You have senators who I think really are looking back at their constituents and saying, you know, this doesn't help my constituents. And a Medicaid rollback for those states, especially as they're in the middle of fighting what's now known to be the largest drug epidemic in this country's history. States like Maine, you have states like Dean Heller's Nevada that are also dealing with these problems. And I think more and more, and again, this is why this speed tactic is so important, because as more and more folks go home and actually speak to their constituents and hear the stories of people who are suffering, who may not have that HCBS benefit for disability home services, people who may lose the early prevention, screening, and diagnostic service for kids under Medicaid. Those are the people, I think, who now are mobilized to fight against this bill. We saw them come to the Hill last week. There were lots of folks in wheelchairs who were arrested on the Hill last week. And what senators really are going to face if they cannot pass this right away is more and more of those folks will be activated and mobilized.
So we've heard quite a bit about the opposition to this bill among the Texas Hospital Association here in the state, the American Medical Association. What industry groups have come out in support of it?
Actually, I think what's remarkable and what hasn't been covered enough here is how almost unanimous the healthcare industry is against the Senate and the House bills here. I think if you look back to Obamacare, there were so many different warring factions between physicians, hospitals, different hospital organizations, the Catholic hospitals versus the private hospitals, the doctors versus the APA. There, you know, I think you could not really predict what side anybody was going to be on. But I think I've looked at dozens and dozens of professional organizations, of hospital organizations, of hospitals, of doctors, and almost to a man, to an organization, they all oppose the bill, and I think that's remarkable. You talk to anybody that's had any experience with the industry, and they'll tell you it's like herding cats, getting them to agree on a single issue, and that was the reason why Obamacare was such an incredibly difficult law to pass. But there's no such splintering among the industry, I think, on the AHCA and on the BCRA.
You're listening to Think on KERA. I'm Lauren Silverman, in for Chris Boyd. On the show this hour, Van Newkirk II. He's a staff writer at The Atlantic, where he covers politics and policy. Join the conversation. The number is 800-933-5372. You can email think@kera.org or send a tweet to @KERAThink. And in a minute, we'll talk about the essential healthcare benefits and mental health care under the Senate bill.
Funding for Think comes from the SMU Master of Liberal Studies program. You can cultivate your appreciation of great works of art by customizing your study with courses this fall like Inspiring Creativity Through Original Art. Applications are available at smu.edu/MLS.
I want to see, and I speak from the heart. That's what I want to see. I want to see a bill with heart. Healthcare is a very complicated subject from the standpoint that you move it this way and this group doesn't like it. You move it a little bit over here. You have a very narrow path. And honestly, nobody can be totally happy, even without the votes. Forget about votes. This has nothing to do with votes. This has to do with picking a plan that everybody's going to like. I'd like to say love, but like.
You're listening to Think. I'm Lauren Silverman, in this week for Chris Boyd. That was President Donald Trump on Fox and Friends this Sunday, talking about how healthcare is a very complicated subject. And this hour, we are tackling that very complicated subject with Atlantic writer Van Newkirk. He covers politics and policy. Van, President Trump talks about developing a bill with heart. When it comes to the essential health benefits that are required under Obamacare, how does the Senate bill compare?
So the Senate bill retains a provision from the House bill, which would allow states to create these waivers. And by those waivers, the states would allow exchange plans to say we're going to cover fewer essential health benefits. So it's feasible a state could say, if they wanted to, allow insurers to offer coverage that doesn't cover maternity care or mental health. And those are actually the two biggest concerns for the CBO. The CBO doesn't predict that lots of states are going to do that, especially now that the Senate bill allows plans to offer more bare bones plans as a whole. But it's still, you know, there still are going to be a few states they predict that are going to do that. And it's going to basically create these islands of coverage where people are going to be able to buy plans, but say not the plans they need. They're not going to be able to, I think a plan that doesn't allow maternity coverage for prospective mothers is rather absurd. But there are going to be more and more of those plans on the marketplace, and they're going to be plans people pay for, but at the end of the day, they don't get exactly what they need out of them.
How about for, you mentioned mental health care, how about for substance abuse? What does the Senate bill do to address this huge issue of substance abuse during the opioid crisis?
So it, in addition to that piece, which lots of people who are involved in substance abuse are really upset about, the potential EHB waivers, which will allow plans to not cover mental health and substance abuse and behavioral health issues. But the Senate bill does, on the back end, it has, I think, a $2 billion fund to fight against the opioid crisis. And I think that's an open-ended appropriation, so they could keep doing that year after year. I'm not sure, though, that that will actually address the needs of the opioid crisis. I think what people are really looking for is they want more coverage, more people who have coverage to have their mental health needs covered. Because I think what we're finding out more and more is that one of the key factors for one of the key predictors of opioid abuse is actually undiagnosed depression. And so if we can get more people diagnosed for depression, if we can get more services covered for people who do have substance abuse disorders, that's actually, I think, what the leading plan of attack for fighting the opioid crisis is. But the government seems to be moving in the opposite direction.
If you want to join the conversation, you can call 800-933-5372. Let's go to someone who's called from Dallas. Mike is on the line. Hi, Mike. How's it going? Are you there, Mike? All right, let's try someone else. Let's go to Bat, who's calling from Fort Worth. Hey, Bat, can you hear us?
Hello.
Hi there.
Hi, I wanted to talk about the fact that even though, despite the names of these bills which talk about health care, really it seems all they're talking about is insurance and the cost of insurance, and never do we discuss the actual cost of the health care that the insurance is paying for. And that's what's driving the cost of insurance up and why people can't afford to have insurance, but nobody really addresses the root problem.
Thank you. That's an interesting point, Van.
That's a great point. And I think one of the biggest criticisms from both sides about the Affordable Care Act is that it actually hasn't quite figured out how to make the most extreme portions of healthcare spending go down. And that's still an open question. I don't think the Senate or the House bill actually addresses that either. What I think most people in the industry are hoping for is that people figure out some plan moving forward, and then they actually get down to the brass tacks of figuring out why healthcare is so expensive. I think what they'll find out is the reason why nobody's answered this question is because it's just so deep and structural, and I think may be so unfixable in some people's eyes that it's just easier to avoid it and look more at coverage.
Now, I'm just seeing on CNN it being reported that Mitch McConnell's planning to delay the vote on the Senate health care bill, according to CNN, which, I mean, now I guess a lot of people have been wondering, would this happen, Van? What calculation do you think McConnell had to make to come to that conclusion, if that's the case?
Wow, breaking news.
Yeah.
So, yeah, if he's delaying this thing, that means he does not have the votes to proceed. That means they have to go through the traditional debate and revision process, which he was hoping to avoid. So if that's true, I think it actually is that's a major victory for people who don't want to see this bill pass. Because, again, if they delay it pass through the recess, they're going to have an opportunity, a much longer opportunity to actually influence votes, to go lobby people to protest and to have these town halls, which I think have been actually really effective at changing minds.
Now, the bad news for you is you're going to have to read a whole new CBO score.
Oh, that's good news. Yeah, I love it.
I just mean for homework. Yeah, so if that's the case, and it says that they would vote after the July 4th break. So that would mean that they would have a chance to hear from people back home. But a lot of, like you said, McConnell was trying to avoid precisely this, and his, one of the reasons he said he was trying to avoid it is because of fear about insurance prices rising in terms of uncertainty and having to submit insurance prices. Is that, explain whether that's a makes sense to you?
Yeah, so insurers under the Affordable Care Act do have a deadline. It is fast approaching to submit their premiums for the next year. They have to submit them for review under the federal government, and the government then has to decide if those rate increases are likely to be increases are fair or not, or if they're gouging their consumers. But I think the federal government can actually delay that deadline in light of advancing legislation. So that excuse doesn't quite hold up. What really I think is going to happen, though, is now, you know, you have that recess. You have basically all the advantages of putting a health care plan in secret, which Republicans in the Senate undoubtedly did. Now that advantage is gone. People have the bill. They have a score. They have people digging into every single corner of every policy and finding all these, you know, things that are going to happen 20 years down the road. And that evidence is mounting. You know, the arguments against the bill are mounting. And now when they come back, if it is delayed, they're going to have to deal with all those arguments and deal with that in debate, in formal debate against other senators. And that really, I think, cuts the chances of this thing passing.
Now, of course, right now, all eyes are really on Senate Republicans. But I've been wondering what goes on behind the scenes with Senate Democrats in intense negotiations like this one in terms of trying to sway people across the aisle. Is that even how might that happen?
Well, I think the lucky thing for Democrats is it doesn't happen all the time, is that they're completely united on this, right?
Yeah.
So, and they have from the outset, basically they've advanced, I think, three really key arguments against the bill, and I think they've resonated with people. One is that I think you've seen studies saying that lack of insurance actually leads to deaths. So they have a number they're putting forward of how many people will die under the new bill. And I think that's a shock tactic that will actually work with lots of people. And they're also, I think, still advancing the pre-existing conditions, language they were saying in the House, which, you know, this bill is actually bad for people with pre-existing conditions, and it makes insurance likely to increase, their premiums increase for them. And I think they're also hitting this bill hard on the process, on it being a secret bill, on there being no debate, on it being totally inverted from the ACA process, where there was so much stakeholder input, so much debate, where there were CBO scores months before it was passed. And those are three really effective strategies. And I think they have moved, they've not only activated traditional liberal and Democrat allies into acting, they have actually moved, I think, independents, some conservatives, into saying, look, this is not a bill I want.
You're listening to Think on KERA. I'm Lauren Silverman, in for Chris Boyd. On the show is Van Newkirk. He's staff writer at The Atlantic, where he covers politics and policy. You can join the conversation by calling 800-933-5372. And let's go to the phones now to Karen, who's calling from Dallas. Hi, Karen. How you doing? Are you there, Karen? All right. Let's go to Mark, who is calling from Dallas. Hi, Mark. You there?
Hi, Chris. Sure. I mean, you've mentioned that the industry is almost unanimously opposed to the bill. The public, once they learn about the bill, seems vast majority of them are against the bill. So my question being, since the senators usually do as their donors or owners want them to do, who actually wants this pig to be passed?
Great question. Van, you touched on this a little bit, but yeah, follow the money. Where's the money?
I think the money is in reelection, actually. Republicans ran on a promise to repeal Obamacare, and I think what they're considering first is how their base sees it. And there's still some evidence, at least on the Medicaid side, that their base is still firmly for at least a strong reform and restriction of Medicaid. So they have to consider that. This has been, I think, such an all-consuming political issue over the last 4 years or so that there are people who ran almost on nothing else other than their promise to repeal Obamacare. So they have to have something in their, some feather in their cap moving forward as we look into 2018 and 2020. But also, you know, I think this has just been sort of among the Republican donor class, among the intellectual elites, the goal has always been, for decades, if you look back decades, has been to roll back Medicaid as a program specifically. I don't know about the subsidies and all that stuff. I think those are mostly in there to make it look more politically palatable. But really, the goal for Republicans and one of their main policy agendas for the last almost 50 years, almost since Medicaid was passed, has been to restrict it. And this bill follows through on their two core promises, which is a restriction of Medicaid and a large tax cut.
Now, you're talking about the money being in re-election and the senators who want to put a feather in their cap and be able to say that they accomplished something when they were on the Hill. And yet a lot of these senators are caught in the middle. And I couldn't think of a better example than Nevada Senator Dean Heller. He's facing threats on both sides. What's happening with him in Nevada?
Oh, yeah, that's... I think he's facing some real pressure. You know, you have your folks who are saying, you know, he was the first person, the first senator to voice his displeasure with the bill. And that earned, you know, he's already been under attack from Democrats and liberals saying he was, you know, if he supports this, there are going to be repercussions. And now I think on the right, people who actually support, who wanted him to run and go defeat Obamacare, saying, whoa, you know, what happened here? And he's been the subject of, I think, the most targeted ads that I've seen. Actually, I think there was a funny episode earlier this week where they were flying airplanes mistakenly over West Virginia saying, Dean Heller, don't vote for this bill.
Oh, no, wrong person.
They've got a long way to go to get to Nevada. But, you know, I think he's been the name on both lists, and that's got to be tough for him.
So hopefully we'll have a little bit more clarity today. It looks like the health care bill will be delayed. Reince Priebus has invited GOP senators to the White House for a 4 p.m. Eastern Time meeting, CNN is reporting. So looking forward, what are you going to have your eye on?
So my eye is on those now, I think it's six senators who have publicly voiced that they don't want to move forward with this. I think the decision to delay means there are more than six. So whether those the others, in addition to that six, come forward, what they say needs to be in the bill. And then we're going to have a round of over the summer between different think tanks, you know, what needs to be added to move the bill forward. I'm going to be following all those, analyzing them. And then, of course, like you said, we'll get another CBO score when they actually come back in the session, when they actually start debating and revising this thing. But
you've,
you know,
got your hands full there. Van Newkirk is a staff writer at The Atlantic. He covers politics and policy. Thank you so much for the time, Van.
Well, thank you.
Think is produced by Stephen Becker. Shelley Canavy is our technical director. Samantha Guzman is associate producer. Jeff Whittington is executive producer. You can follow us on Facebook and Twitter. Our handle is @KERA Think. Thanks for listening and enjoy the rest of your day.